From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. There's a new salvo today in the negotiations to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. Pyongyang is threatening to pull out of next month's summit with President Trump if the United States insists that the North unilaterally give up its nuclear weapons. In an angry statement, North Korea's vice foreign minister criticized National Security Advisor John Bolton, who recently said North Korea should follow a Libya model of verifiable denuclearization. Here's Bolton on Face the Nation.
The one thing that Libya did that led us to overcome our skepticism was that they allowed American and British observers into all their nuclear-related sites. So it wasn't a question of relying on international mechanisms. We saw them in ways we had never seen before.
President Trump said today that we'll have to see if the summit is still on. Let's bring in Balbina Wong. She's a visiting professor at Georgetown University and a former senior advisor at the State Department. She's with us on a Skype line from Seoul. And Balbina, what are you hearing today in Seoul about this sudden shift from North Korea?
Well, in fact, this is not quite a sudden shift. Remember, this is Foreign Minister Kim Kye-gwan, who is has been for quite a long time the lead negotiator that was involved in the discussions and negotiations of the denuclearization process for North Korea. And remember, too, that Kim Kye-gwan is the gentleman that is quite familiar with John Bolton, because John Bolton was in the W. Bush administration, and he was the one that was the undersecretary for nonproliferation. Now, North Korea is very familiar with this history of what happened with Libya. Muammar Gaddafi was so terrified of what had happened with Iraq and Saddam Hussein, and so had willingly given up his fledgling nuclear program, which, by the way, had not really gotten off the ground, and was willing to give it up in exchange for essentially amnesty. But of course, what happened afterwards is well known in history.
He ended up dead.
That's exactly right.
And is that the fear now, that the North has, that Kim Jong-un could end up in the same place?
Well, yes, that's exactly right. But now what is happening today is that Kim Kye-gwan is the foreign minister. Now, President Trump would not be meeting Kim Kye-gwan. President Trump would be meeting Kim Jong-un. What is very interesting about this is that nobody in North Korea, other than Kim Jong-un, has ever been, you know, punished for ever sticking his neck out and sounding fierce and coming out and sounding very, very tough and very strong and threatening. The point being that Kim Jong-un does not punish anybody for sounding very, very hardline.
So is this then a negotiating tactic, or is there actually a real threat that the North is ready to walk away? Sounds like you're saying it might just be a negotiating tactic.
Well, this is precisely the point. We simply don't know, but I also don't think that we should be alarmed right now and assume that North Korea is absolutely walking away and that the summit has fallen apart and that now we are back to, you know, on the precipice of, you know, back to the possibility of, you know, nuclear war. I simply don't think that's the case. And I think we have to still give it a chance, and that this could yet be the initial stages of the pre-negotiation process, because this is exactly the pattern that we have always typically seen with North Korea.
Do you think the North suddenly felt it had given up too much ahead of these talks? Because we had seen Kim Jong-un and South Korea's Moon Jae-in pledge to work for a nuclear-free peninsula publicly. The North had said it was willing to allow military exercises go forward between the South and the United States previously. The North had invited reporters out to watch the shutdown of a nuclear test site, the only one in the country. I mean, do you think that all of a sudden they realized maybe they needed to make this turn and come down a little harder?
No, not necessarily. And the reason I say that is because in that case, we would be making the assumption that North Korea had sort of recklessly or impulsively raced to make this sudden turn and had decided impulsively to go ahead and, engage in this kind of very sudden change. And I don't think that that is the case. I think that, in fact, Kim Jong-un is not this crazy, impulsive leader. I think that he's actually very rational. I think that he has been very calculated, and that for the last 5 years that he has been in power, he has very steadily proceeded with his program. And I think that what we have seen recently was the result of a very, very steady and carefully plotted strategic decision that he has made. And so, no, I don't think this was an impulsive decision. Mm-hmm. And so, which is why I think that what is happening today is part of a longer term strategy. And so I don't think that we should be panicking. And I think we should let this play out and see what happens.
The mood from the White House over the last couple of weeks has been so optimistic. Do you think it's been too optimistic and that the U.S. has underestimated the strategy of the North?
Possibly, but it's quite hard to tell what exactly is going on inside this White House. President Trump is making all his own decisions. Secretary Pompeo, Bolton, they seem to be quite confident in their roles as his advisors. But in the end, I think President Trump is the decider. Hmm. I think President Trump is going to decide during the meeting, if it happens with Chairman Kim. He will decide whatever he wants to decide to do.
And in a word, who has the upper hand going into that meeting if it happens now?
That is the most unusual circumstance. I think that these two very unusual leaders are evenly matched.
Balbina Wong, a visiting professor at Georgetown University and former senior advisor at the U.S. State Department. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Well, school districts across North Carolina are closed today as teachers rally at the state capitol asking for more money. The rally is the latest in a string of teacher uprisings across the country. We've seen similar actions in West Virginia, Kentucky, Oklahoma, Arizona, and Colorado. In North Carolina, teachers actually have been given 6% raises for years, but the state is still below the national average on teacher pay. Liz Schlemmer is an education reporter with North Carolina Public Radio. She's at the capitol. Liz, tell us what's happening where you are.
There are supposedly 20,000 teachers here today, educators, principals, parents. They met down at the North Carolina Association of Educators and then marched up to the General Assembly building and are trying to get into the gallery.
And they are asking for more money. Lawmakers there say that teachers have received raises in the last 4 years and will have a 6% raise in the upcoming year. But the teachers say it's not just about money for them. What do teachers want?
Well, it is really about money to them, but it's not just about teacher pay. It's about spending for students. The per student spending in this state is ranked 39th in the country. So they want more resources for their schools. They want for schools to be repaired. They want more equipment for their classrooms. They want more supplies. And they also say that those teacher pay raises have not been across the board and have not always been equitable. And they're also making complaints about cuts that have been made in the past decade, including pay for having a master's degree and eliminating many support positions like teacher's assistants. I spoke to one teacher assistant and parent, Erica Johnson.
My job has been cut 3 times, and each time they've called me back, but at what cost? So I now do the job of 4 people. As to what it used to be, one. The expectations increase, the pay does not. I prefer for my daughter not to be taught in a trailer and to have class size and to have textbooks versus sitting on a computer all day long and textbooks that are up to date.
So teachers are talking about far more than just their own pay. They're talking about support positions. They're talking about the working conditions in schools.
And the governor of North Carolina has actually proposed boosting teacher pay by 8%. Is that something that's likely to happen?
We haven't heard those kinds of numbers from any other politicians. Mm. And this legislature has a supermajority of Republicans. It's unlikely that the governor's request will be met. Democrats, House Democrats, are also supporting the governor's budget request, but we haven't seen any other specific numbers come out like that.
And the Republican president pro tem of the Senate, I know, has said that the teachers are paid enough. What are people on the other side of this fight saying?
What we've heard from legislators is that, you know, they think that teachers should be in school today, that this is something that is detrimental to students, that so many districts have closed. 38 districts across the state, largely urban districts, were closed today. And, you know, they say they'd rather have teachers in school.
Are they going to be back in school tomorrow?
Yes, I have not heard of any plans for teachers that they will be out of school tomorrow.
That's Liz Schlemmer, education reporter for North Carolina Public Radio, joining us from the state capitol in Raleigh. Liz, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Peter, there is something that's gone viral online that we have to talk about. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like that dress. Is it blue or is it gold? Different people see it different ways. Now it's an audio clip, so it's perfect for us. And the question is, when you hear this, do you hear Laurel or Yanni?
Laurel. Laurel. Laurel.
So I think there's no question there.
It's no question at all.
It's Laurel. It's Laurel.
Laurel. Totally.
In fact, I'm not sure whether the debate is about Yanni or Yanni, because I don't hear that word. Some people hear both, apparently. But tell us what you hear. We're on Twitter at Here and Now, at Jeremy Hobson, at O'Dowd Peter. It's Laurel.
The two words aren't even close. Laurel.
New York Magazine reports this week that President Trump and Fox News host Sean Hannity talk on the phone almost every night before bedtime. Perhaps no surprise, then, that the two men often say the same things. Listen to this montage that CNN put together.
There was no collusion with Russia.
A conspiracy theory that was cooked up by the Obama administration, by Democrats.
Really a hoax created largely by the Democrats.
As an excuse for why Hillary Clinton lost the election. That was never supposed to happen.
Softening the blow of a loss, which is a loss that, frankly, they shouldn't have had.
Olivia Nuzzi is Washington correspondent for New York Magazine. She wrote the story on the Trump-Hannity bromance. Olivia, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So why did the two of these men talk every night?
That's a great question. Neither of them would speak to me for this article. The White House initially said that they were going to produce a statement and then decided not to, I guess, kind of ghosted me on that one. And Fox News denied repeated interview requests. So I could not ask them directly what is behind this friendship. And it almost seems codependent in some ways.
But they're not denying that these conversations are taking place.
No, not directly denying that these conversations are taking place. And a lot of, you know, the White House officials I spoke to, current and former, spoke about how frequently the president will enter a room and say that he just hung up with Sean Hannity. He has called Sean Hannity in front of them from his desk. But generally what happens in the residence after he has retired for the evening, normally around 7 o'clock, is a total mystery to them. They don't know much about what he's up to.
Well, do you have a sense of whether he's calling Hannity or Hannity's calling him?
So my impression, based on the reporting, is that Hannity most often calls the White House switchboard, and the operator then refers to a list of cleared callers. It's a few dozen people. It's mostly family members, Eric, Don Jr. I didn't hear whether or not Tiffany was on that list, and a couple of famous businessmen, the owner of the Patriots, Rupert Murdoch. And the White House switchboard operator will then call the president. If the president is available, Hannity will be put through. I do believe that there are definitely times, in the evening at least, when the president does call Sean Hannity. He certainly does call other friends of his. And it's really interesting, you know, this didn't make it into the story, but there was a report earlier this month, I believe on CNN. A reporter said that the president, by way of evading John Kelly's efforts to control him, was hiding out in the Situation Room and calling his friends. And this has kind of led to some confusion. People have it in their mind that the president is like pacing around in the Situation Room in this, you know, empty room where big decisions are made, hiding out from people who are trying to control him and calling his friends. But in reality, based on my reporting, he's probably in bed or on the couch in the residence.
Do you get the sense that these conversations are more of Sean Hannity giving advice to the president or the president trying to program Sean Hannity's show on a nightly basis?
You know, I don't. My impression is that it's not really the latter, or if it is the latter, it's not a conscious effort. It's not as though Sean Hannity needs to be manipulated into doing what the president wants. I mean, their interests are pretty aligned. Mm-hmm. They both want what the president wants. The show kind of seems to be, in a lot of ways, a reflection of the complaints and various agitations that the president has that they do talk about. And it seems, based on everything that I understand from people close to Sean Hannity, people close to Donald Trump, people close to both of them, that it really is a friendship to the extent that Donald Trump can have a true friendship. And they talk about all sorts of things. I mean, they talk, you know, just general, how's your day going? What's it like over there for you? But they also talk a lot about the business of television and media, a lot about ratings, which is astonishing to me. You know, everyone kept saying that during my reporting. They talk about the ratings. They're both obsessed with numbers, with ratings. But they like to gossip and talk about the people that they both know in the media and who's doing well and who's not. And obviously the answer, at least for the duration of this administration, has been that Sean Hannity is doing well, which means, by extension, Donald Trump is doing well.
You reveal that in the early days of the administration, when Reince Priebus was chief of staff and Sean Spicer was the press secretary, they actually began a campaign in the White House to get Trump to watch Fox News more because he'd get so angry when he was watching the other networks in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we remember it was right out in the open. We all saw it. The president would kind of live tweet his viewing of Morning Joe on MSNBC and, to a lesser extent, the programming on CNN like New Day. And he would kind of react in real time to the personalities on there, specifically Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski, or he would react to the programming and he would get very angry. And sometimes, as I write in the piece, by like 11 o'clock in the morning, which is sometimes or oftentimes when he has his daily intelligence briefing, you know, when his day officially starts, the entire day would be thrown off course. We'd be trying to figure out what he meant with this tweet or that tweet, and it would kind of throw off course everything that the people in the White House in charge of trying to plan were trying to do. So early on, Sean Spicer and Reince Priebus made an effort to kind of convince him, manipulate him really, into watching more Fox and Friends until all that was left was what a current White House official called a, quote, complete dosage of Fox.
Well, and clearly that has worked because he loves Fox and Friends. He tweets about it. He goes on there. He went on there for a half an hour.
Of course. And he really does love it. But as the current White House official told me, this has created sort of this secondary problem that is in a lot of ways worse than when he was tweeting angrily about, you know, Mika Brzezinski allegedly bleeding badly from a facelift. They described it in terms I probably can't say on this program, but expletive feedback loop now where he watches the programming on Fox. Oftentimes it has nothing to do with the news of the day or, you know, they're blowing something up that doesn't really have the meaning that Fox would like it to have. And the president is reacting to that and sending these messages out to the world. And the White House is left kind of chasing behind him, trying to figure out what on earth he's talking about.
Yeah, I was looking at FoxNews.com yesterday while we were, you know, covering Gaza and all the other things that are going on in the world. And their top story, you know, huge banner across the front page, was about a Cheesecake Factory worker who wore a Make America Great Again hat and, you know, suffered the consequences.
It's crazy. You know, even listening most days, you know, reporting this story, I would listen to as much of Sean Hannity's radio show that I could. It's 3 hours a day, and then he has the Fox News show at night for an hour, so it's quite a lot of content. But I would turn it on, and he'd be talking about something that I had never heard of in some cases. And oftentimes, you know, I would look into it and it would have some basis in reality. It would be a story that didn't, you know, receive much attention, oftentimes for good reason. It just wasn't that important. Or sometimes it would just be something, just a complete willful misreading of something that happened in the news. And when you are in that universe for hours every day, or even just for Fox and Friends in the morning, Sean Hannity at night, I can imagine it's quite distorting. I mean, it is distorting.
One of the things that these two men, Sean Hannity and Donald Trump, have in common, we now know, is that they are both clients of Michael Cohen, Trump's attorney. And so I want to get your thoughts on this supposedly breaking news from Rudy Giuliani on Sean Hannity's show. Let's listen to what happened here.
That money was not campaign money. Sorry, I'm giving you a fact now that you don't know. It's not campaign money. No campaign finance violation. So
they funneled it through the law firm.
Funneled through the law firm, and the president repaid it.
Oh, I didn't know. He did.
Yeah.
There's no campaign finance law.
Zero.
He's talking, of course, about the money paid to the porn star Stormy Daniels. Do you believe that, that he didn't know that, given that they're talking every night, Trump and Hannity?
I do, just because based on my knowledge of those conversations, they seem to be pretty scattered all over the place. One minute they're talking about Kanye West. The next minute they're complaining about the witch hunt, the Robert Mueller investigation into potential Russian collusion, obviously. Or the next minute they're talking about CNN's ratings. It doesn't seem that, you know, the real pressing questions of the day are things that are necessarily what they are talking about going down some sort of list of important issues.
Let me ask you one more thing, because you talk a lot about Sean Hannity and the business at Fox News, and it sounds like he does not have a good relationship, at least not yet, with the Murdoch son, James Murdoch, who's going to take over the business, that they've only talked once?
My understanding, based on my reporting, is that they met briefly once at a Yankees game, and that is it. I also understand that he does not have any relationship really with management at Fox News. He does not take management's calls. And from his perspective, I can sort of understand it. He is their most popular host. He probably makes that company, I'm just guessing, but more than anybody else in terms of the host of the shows. And so I kind of understand that mentality, but it is pretty astonishing when you think about it that one of the most powerful people in media, arguably given his relationship with the president, the most popular person at that network, he is viewed most nights or some nights more than all of the late night comedy hosts. So it doesn't surprise me that he doesn't really have much of a relationship or doesn't take seriously calls from management. But at the same time, my impression is that management is not really reaching out too much, that they're not trying to meddle in the way that I think a lot of people at Fox News, including Sean Hannity, seem to fear might happen in the post-Ailes era.
That's Olivia Nuzzi, Washington correspondent for New York Magazine, and we will link you to her story about Sean Hannity and Donald Trump at our website, hereandnow.org. Olivia, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Researchers across the country are looking to use precision medicine to treat people with depression. Precision therapies, or treatments that zero in on the genetic makeup of the patient, have been successful treating certain types of cancer. Megan Thielking is a reporter with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. And Megan, let's define some terms here. Remind us what precision medicine is and how it's been used to treat cancer.
Precision medicine, really broadly, is this approach in which researchers drill down into a patient's individual characteristics, their genes, their environment, their lifestyle, that kind of thing, and then they use that information to pinpoint the best treatment for one patient. A really well-known example is CAR T therapy for cancer, which involves taking a blood out of a patient's arm, engineering the immune cells to make it attack that patient's tumors, and then putting them back in. So it's super specific to every patient.
And now researchers see this opportunity with depression, which of course applies to a lot of people. About 16 million American adults had at least one major depressive episode in 2012. Why go after that disease?
Yeah, so like you said, it's super prevalent, but by and large, depression just gets thought of as depression. So it's all lumped together, even though there's a lot of variation within the disease. So one patient might be a teenager who's experiencing depression for the first time and has suicidal thoughts, and another patient might be an elderly adult who's experiencing their third bout of depression and doesn't have suicidal thoughts, but has difficulty doing everyday activities. So there's a lot of variation, and doctors and researchers are hoping to really find the right treatment for each patient, as opposed to thinking of as sort of one lumped together disease.
So what does precision medicine then in the context of depression look like? What techniques are people using?
There's a lot of different research happening right now. Some researchers are doing genetic testing and others are drawing blood and looking for potential biomarkers that might show early signs of depression. Some are doing brain scans to see if there's differences in brain circuitry that might be able to be broken down into different types of depression. But as they're collecting all that data, they're sort of also grappling with the question of what to do with it and whether it can really be used to define neat, tidy subtypes of depression.
Right, because isn't the issue with depression, and you kind of hinted at this already, is that a lot of things could contribute to someone suffering from the disease. It could be a life event that triggers a depressive episode. It could be genetics. It could be something else.
Yeah, 100%. It's just so difficult to parse, and I think that's why some people are skeptical about this precision approach to depression. It's just because, you know, certainly there are genetic variants that contribute to depression, but there might be thousands of them, and they might be combined in different ways, and there might be differences in brain circuits from one person with depression compared to one person who doesn't have depression. But how do you tease out what's causing depression versus changes that are caused by depression versus just noise on a brain scan?
Is there a feeling among these researchers that techniques that we've used in the past, like antidepressants or behavioral therapy, aren't working well enough?
I think there is good evidence that antidepressants and behavioral therapy work well for a lot of people. So it's not just about finding new treatments. It's sort of about finding the right first treatment. In depression, especially with antidepressants, they can take a while to start working. Mm-hmm. So if they don't work, patients end up sort of going through this cycle of waiting a few weeks to find out if they work, and if they don't, starting again. And it can end up being a really lengthy process. Certainly, there also is interest in developing new treatments as well, because there are patients who don't respond to any therapies right now.
That's Megan Thielking, a reporter at STAT. Megan, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Pony Express only lasted 18 months, but the mail delivery service remains one of the most enduring icons of the American West. Its story told in dime novels and in westerns like the 1990s TV show The Young Riders.
Have a great ride, kid!
The Pony Express used horse and rider relay teams to speed letters across the West just before the start of the Civil War. The route was from St. Joseph, Missouri to Sacramento, California, a distance of about 2,000 miles, and the pony could do it in just 10 days, a time so swift it practically made grown men weep, as Jim DeFelice writes in his new book, West Like Lightning, The Brief Legendary Ride of the Pony Express. He joins us now from NPR in New York to talk about it. Jim DeFelice, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Take us back to the fall of 1860. That's when your book starts. Abraham Lincoln had just been elected president, and the pony is bringing news of that election across the West. What does the pony represent at that point in American history?
Well, at that point in American history, the pony and the country is kind of at a huge crux. Everybody knows that there's a war coming if Lincoln is elected, and the owners of the Pony Express have put on extra horses, extra riders. They're using the latest technology, the telegraph, to get the information from Missouri all the way to California as quickly as possible. And I use that run to kind of structure the book and talk about not just the Pony Express, but also what's going on in America at that time.
Hmm. What I loved learning about this, I mean, the politics, as you mentioned, were vivid that were happening at the time. But also, this is a story of American business. And there were connections with the pony to some of the biggest names in modern American business today. Wells Fargo and American Express. Explain that.
Well, you know, when we think of the Pony Express now, we think of horses and young men racing across all sorts of different terrain. But that wasn't entirely the plan that William Russell and his two partners, Alexander Majors and William Waddell, were after. They wanted to do that, but that was going to be part of this entire empire to get goods, information, money, and just about anything else that had to move from the Missouri River all the way to California. They not only did they have the Pony Express, they had a stagecoach line. Actually, they had several stagecoach lines. They had ox carts. They had a bank. They had an insurance company. They were basically trying to create an empire. Now, that same plan had been used to great effect less than two decades before in Upper New York when the Erie Canal opened and connected New York City to the West, to what was then the West and what was then the frontier. That company is still with us. It's American Express. So very possibly, had the pony succeeded, we wouldn't be leaving home without the pony rather than American Express.
That is amazing. Well, what about the young men who did the work? You quote from Mark Twain, who wrote about the Pony Express in his book, Roughing It. Twain says, "The pony rider is a little bit of a man, brimful of spirit and endurance." Who are these guys who are making these rides?
They're basically 19, 20, 21-year-olds. They are on the thin side. In a lot of cases, they're fairly short because the lesser load that would be on the horse, the better, and the faster, at least in theory, the faster the horse can go. And they're being paid incredibly well, $100 a month in many instances. And that was when $100 was actually real money. Huh. These guys are the rock stars, the athletes of the day, and everybody lionized them. When they came into town, they didn't have to pay for their drinks. We'll put it that way.
And they earned their money, though, because this was incredibly hard work. It was freezing cold in the winter. It was dangerously hot in the summer. There were vast, empty stretches of open desert. There was a war with Native Americans in the middle of this. I mean, this was not easy work.
Absolutely. And when they went to, when they would stay at one of the stations, they would take generally two runs a week. They would, they'd sleep in a stable more often than not, or, if they were really lucky, in an attic. So they were earning their money. You're right.
One of the lines that I loved in this book was, talking about how important speed is to get from Missouri to California. And at one point, a pony executive says, "Boys, if you kill a horse by riding too hard, we'll get you a new one," which I think makes a pretty important point that speed was the name of this game.
Absolutely. And, he's saying that at a time they want the fastest horses that they can possibly get. They're paying $400 a horse, and that's quite a lot of money at the time.
And they only lost, one bag of mail the entire time?
Absolutely. But here's the thing about that one bag of mail that disappeared somewhere, probably – well, we'll let you read the book to get the details. But it turns up later on. So really, these guys were like perfect. They always delivered the mail. Maybe a little late, but that happens.
It was a really tough business. I mean, it was a tough ride, but it was also really hard to make money doing this. It lost tons of cash, and one of the founders was arrested for defrauding the U.S. government through his bond deal to finance the operation. What happened there?
If your business plan calls on counting on a government contract, you may run into a little bit of trouble fulfilling it. And if you're really counting on being able to borrow money from the government that the government doesn't actually have, that also can be a big problem.
It was a complicated time for the U.S. government leading up to the U.S. Civil War.
Absolutely. And that actually ends up helping William Russell, who's the one who – let's face it, he was kiting checks. And we're not talking about cutting $10 checks. These are thousands and thousands and thousands of dollar checks. And he's defrauding people on Wall Street as well as the U.S. government. If he had done it at any other time, he probably would have gone to jail for the rest of his life. But he was fortunate enough, if that's the right word – to do it at a time that the government was in flux, and there were also maybe some congressmen who didn't want all of the details to come out.
But were those financial troubles the reason that the pony collapsed? Because we also always hear about the rise of the telegraph at this time, the rise of the railroad. What did the Pony Express in after only 18 months?
Actually, it was the finances, and there's this little thing called the Civil War that disrupt things. The pony was seen as kind of a short-term venture. Russell and his partners wanted to do something really big to capture the imagination of the people in the West and also to get a lot of support from Congress to get $1 million contract from the government to deliver the mail, which would help them build their infrastructure and actually pay a lot of their bills. The plan succeeded in terms of being able to deliver the mail. As we say, they didn't really lose anything. In terms of PR, it was huge. Everybody knew what the Pony Express was. We still do.
And part of the reason we knew was because of Buffalo Bill Cody and his Wild West shows, who helped sort of build the myth and the legend behind the Pony Express.
Absolutely. And Buffalo Bill Cody was the greatest rider of the Pony Express ever.
Huh.
The problem is he never actually rode. But, you know, it's a little technicality. Yeah.
Right. What you point out in the book, that there's so much about this time in history and about the Pony Express, we're not even really sure if it happened. Why is that?
There's a lot of legends that are related to the Old West and to the Pony Express specifically. And I do try to separate fact from fiction, but I still want to celebrate the legends. I mean, first of all, they're fun for the most part, and they also speak to kind of a greater truth for us and tell us about what's important to our country, the distance and speed, but also perseverance. Hmm. When the riders are bragging, they're not bragging about how fast they went 10 miles or 100 miles. They brag about their endurance. They brag about how far they went, the time that they went 360 miles or 380, enduring hardship and just kind of getting through it.
So in this modern age, you think the Pony Express still resonates?
Absolutely.
Huh. Jim DeFelice's new book is West Like Lightning, The Brief Legendary Ride of the Pony Express. Jim, it was a great book. Thanks for speaking with us about it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Argentina's currency, the peso, has been in free fall. It's fallen more than 30% against the U.S. dollar this year alone, and the International Monetary Fund is due to begin discussions with Argentina's government about a possible bailout. Joining us now from Buenos Aires is the BBC's Daniel Pardo. And Daniel, what is causing what's being described in some headlines as an economic crisis in Argentina?
Well, one of the first things that we need to think about is it really an economic crisis? In a country with a history of hyperinflation, with huge devaluations, with political outrage because of the economy, I wouldn't say this is an economic crisis. Okay. The country, the economy is partly slowly growing. There's not huge tension on the street. And the dollar, even though that it's, you know, in very tough times going, it calmed down. It's going down today and yesterday. But it does show that there's deep holes in Argentine's economies and that to fix them is going to take a lot of time. One, for instance, is the huge dependence on the dollar. The dollar here marks almost every price.
You can use dollars if you want to when you're in Argentina.
To rent an apartment, to buy a car, all those big transactions, you need to pay them dollars. There's no other way to do it. Hmm. You really need to understand that the dollar here is huge and everyone's always speaking about it. You know, you can ask anyone, they'll tell you what the dollar rate is today. That doesn't happen in any Latin American country. Now, this is a historical problem, and Macri says that that is something that he inherited from previous governments. But the current opposition, is saying that someone who turned Argentine's economy to the international markets and increased that dependence was indeed Macri. Macri solved the debt that he had with American bondholders, and he started to get debt from international bonds. And that obviously made the economy more vulnerable to what happened internationally.
You're talking about Mauricio Macri, who's the president of Argentina.
Exactly.
But what is he doing now? As you say, he's paid off debt that Argentina had. But now you are seeing a peso that is falling in comparison to the dollar. What's he doing now to deal with this problem?
Well, he did a couple of things. First of all, well, as you were saying, he called the IMF, which is a very controversial measure in this country because the IMF has a very long history of failed attempts to solve Argentine's economic crisis. The last one was in 2001 when dozens of people died in political riots because the economy was failed in all sorts of ways. And the IMF had a huge part in that. So that shows that it was kind of like his last card to take out, right? But he did it. He did it, and in some way that calmed the situation in a way. The other things that he did, or the central bank did, was that they increased the interest rate of local bonds in pesos, which would invite people to save their money in pesos and even invest in local bonds. The interest rate in this country right now is 40%. is the highest in the world. It's huge. So it's really profitable to invest in local bonds. The thing is that you have a huge risk because of the possible devaluation. Right. And the other thing that the central bank did was that they invested a lot of money in the exchange market. They put $5 billion in the exchange market, and that has in a way lowered down or calmed down the dollar.
So the question in this country, in the United States, is what's happening in Argentina going to bleed into economies elsewhere, maybe elsewhere in South America or even around the world?
I don't think so. I mean, the economy in Argentina is very, very closed. It's very specific and doesn't have huge links with other economies in Latin America. There's a very good example to show that Argentina's economy is different. The devaluation of the peso in the past 3 weeks had to do with the increase of interest rates in the U.S. But the only currency that devalued so much in the region was the peso in Argentina. It didn't happen in Colombia, Chile, Brazil, other economies that do depend on the American dollar, but didn't see this outrage with the dollar. So, I mean, this shows that Argentina's economy is more vulnerable than others in Latin America, and it has huge holes that need time and, you know, bold measures to be fixed.
So how is this playing out there where you are on the streets of Buenos Aires? Are people feeling the pinch, or is this something that they're just talking about at the moment?
Argentines are Italians.
Right.
And in a way, so they speak a lot about these things, you know, and they see it as the end of the world in a way. It is most likely that this devaluation of the peso is going to generate more inflation. Stopping inflation is one of Macri's main objectives. And if he ends up this year with the same figure as he ended up last year, it shows that his economic policy has been partly failed.
That's the BBC's Daniel Pardo speaking with us from Buenos Aires in Argentina. Daniel, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.